everybody. Welcome to this event on workshopping your application. We're doing this as is normal in a hybrid kind of format, normal for now. So I've got someone in the room and I'm speaking to you all online as well. Unfortunately, our camera isn't working in the room, so I'm speaking to you from my laptop, but I'm going to be sharing my screen in a little bit and then talking through some of the documents and some of the details of the application process that is that I wanted to really that's central to this whole event and what we're going to be doing today. So if you have your camera and you'd like to turn it on and you'd like to kind of join in the conversation, please feel free to do so. It's great to see people as well as to hear from them. What I'm going to do, and my name is Tanya Harmer, I'm the director of the PhD program in the International History Department. What I'm going to be doing today is not replicating the open day session that I did last month. I don't want to repeat too much of what I said then. What I want to focus in on instead is some of the key documents that you need to include in your application, particularly your statement of purpose and your research proposal. I want to talk through some of the do's and don'ts, what to do, what not to do in terms of the application. But also I want to talk a little bit about what happens when you've submitted your application. And then I'm going to end on funding opportunities as well. And apologies for email notification going off just then. All right, I'm going to just share my screen now with you. And we'll get started with our presentation. As you're all here, so you've all kind of seen the flyers, you've sort of seen the event publicity, and so you know why we're here. Let me just jump right in and talk about some of the application documents that you will need when you're applying to the PhD. The PhD application obviously being comprised of a number of different documents, but one of the central documents that we ask for is a statement of purpose, right? Now I'm putting up material that you will have already seen online. In terms of what a statement of purpose should include, and we're talking about a kind of two-sided A4 paper length document. It should be about 1,000 to 1,500 words. We're not talking about a really extensive essay here, but we're talking about a quite concise statement of why you really want to undertake a PhD in international history. So things to include in the statement are up there on the slide for you. Things like your motivation for undertaking the program, your academic interests, your strengths and background that might be relevant to a PhD in international history. So when we're looking at applications coming into our department to study for a PhD, we're really looking for a synergy, a match between your research interests and our particular department and our staff and our faculty. What are your strengths and interests that make you an ideal candidate to come and study in the Department of International History, where we study, you know, we prioritize kind of study of the relationships between people, societies, comparative history, international, transnational, kind of global history. What are the areas of specific interest within this kind of international approach to studying the past that you might find particularly interesting? It's also useful to include your academic ambitions and or research interests that are related to the program. So what do you particularly want to learn? What are your academic ambitions, perhaps beyond a PhD? Are you interested in going into academia? Or are you interested in using this research for other, other types of career trajectories? What are your professional aspirations that would lead on from the PhD? So we're not just looking for those for people who want to go and study for a PhD. I mean, to the contrary, in fact, to those who want to go on to academia, the job market in academia is not what we would like it to be. It's very hard to get into the academic profession today. So we were looking for people who are thinking about doing a PhD for multiple and multitude of different reasons. We're looking for people who can really explain what they hope to gain from this very intensive research project, a 4-year if it's full time, or a kind of 8-year long intensive research project if you decided to do it part time. We also ask that you include any other relevant information in your statement of purpose, particularly a relevant experience that has informed your decision to apply to the LSE and to specifically the Department of International History. And I'm going to move on now to talk about our studentship criteria, or the criteria that we're using to assess the LSE studentship offers that we give. Because this is where the statement of purpose is really where you would want to include some of the things we're looking for in your statement of purpose to underline, you know, why you might be particularly eligible or particularly suitable for doing a PhD and eligible for one of those studentships as well. So let me move on to the next slide then. And you'll see that we've got a studentship criteria that it comprises of a number of different components that we're looking for. And so when you're drafting those statements of purpose, you want to talk about why you want to study a PhD, how this is going to lead to your, you know, your future career. You want to talk about what really motivates you to undertake a PhD. But you know, you might also be wanting to signal why you're very an ideal candidate for our studentships and for being offered a place in the program. And so let me just point to these different criteria up on the screen. We've got academic performance to date listed here. Now, as per our requirements, we require a 67 and above at MSc level overall and in the MSc's dissertation. So if you've done very well in all your courses, but the dissertation doesn't quite go well, this might be problematic in that the dissertation is really where we see your proven quality of being able to undertake high quality level research. We give a priority to those with an MSc in hand when we're looking at the student, when we're awarding studentships. That means those who have already graduated rather than those that are in the middle of your master's. If, and I know that this is the case in several countries in my own area of expertise in Latin America, if you're in the middle of a master's program, but the master's program in your particular area, country or region is an intensive, like multiple year level master's. In Latin America, sometimes master's can be almost similar to the kind of PhD, 3 years and very long kind of research projects. State that in this in your statement of purpose. Explain the length and the detail and the depth you've gone into in your statement of purpose in your master's research already. But you'll also see that a priority is given to those who can demonstrate an upward trajectory in academic performance, or rather equal consideration is given to those who can demonstrate an upward trajectory in academic performance. So yes, it's wonderful if you've got a first at undergraduate and you've got a distinction at master's level. But if it took a bit of time in your undergraduate to decide or to what you wanted to specialize on, or if it took a little bit of time to show to hit the ground running when it came to your academic studies, and then you've moved from strength to strength, you know, that learning curve and that what helped you to kind of rise up on that learning curve is something to mention in your statement of purpose. We're looking also, going on to the second point, we're looking for you to have a preparedness in language ability. And I say this because to carry out research on international history, it is absolutely fundamental that you have the languages that enable you to carry out international history. If you wanted to look at, for example, Hong Kong's place within the global Cold War, you know, we would expect you to have more than English to be able to do that, to be able to have the language abilities, to be able to study sources within Hong Kong as well. If you're doing Latin American research, you need Spanish, Portuguese. You may also consider thinking about kind of some of the other languages within Latin America that might be of interest. If you're studying, want to study for a PhD in African history, have you got languages coming from Africa? Have you got African languages as well? Or if you're not prepared to study, not prepared to dive into the archives already with a very expert knowledge of that language, what are your plans to learn the language, right? What are your plans now? What are you doing to learn Swahili? What are you doing to learn Mandarin? What are you doing to learn Spanish now that will put you in a position to be able to hit the ground running when you start the PhD? We're also looking, and here's the next two points, we're looking for people who have skills that are particularly central to the PhD experience. So I think there's a kind of misconception sometimes that you're very good at kind of school and undergraduate masters, and then you can just, the PhD is just a continuation of those things. But the PhD program is slightly different, right? You're on your own to a large time, parts of the process. You spend a lot of time working on your own, researching on your own. It's a very long period of research. It's a long project. There's not as much kind of contact hours and continuous teaching as you do have in a master's or an undergraduate. So you have to be able to demonstrate a capacity to work on your own, to overcome hurdles that you might face when archives don't give you what you're looking for, but to also manage time and manage big, large projects. And so in your statement of purpose, you might also be wanting to show, you know, non-linear pathways to the PhD or your ability to overcome challenges. How have you proven resilience in the past? How have you shown that you can sustain and maintain your interest and your commitment to a certain project or an idea? And how have you worked to manage a big a project? And this could be through professional experience, but it could be also through caring responsibilities. One of the things of a PhD is juggling between your secondary, primary research. You might be juggling teaching responsibilities in your second, third year. You might be kind of taking on a kind of role in administrative kind of convening of research seminars. How do you manage your time? How do you prioritize? And how do you make sure that you're able to give priorities where time to priorities, but also to fulfill all your obligations at the same time. The last two points are kind of self-explanatory, but I would say that the last one, the enthusiastic supervisor statement, is something that can only really, well, it is helped if you are in contact with your potential supervisor already, that you've already got their interest, that you've already got their backing and enthusiasm for applying before you actually even apply to do the PhD. So enthusiastic supervisor statement is not something to include in the statement of purpose, but it can only really result from the kind of process that leads up to you actually submitting your application. So let me just kind of recap on the studentship statement of purpose here. So we've talked about all the different things that would need to go in a statement of purpose. Let me just add a couple more things, and then I might actually just see if anyone's got any questions before I move on to the research proposal itself. When you're outlining your state, you know, drafting your statement of purpose and saying why you want to study in the International History Department and why particularly our program meets your research interests and draws you to apply to the LSC, it's worth underlining who you want to work with and specifying who the supervisors are that you'd like to actually work under their supervision. Have you spoken to them already? It doesn't necessarily need to be someone it needs to be someone within our department. and I would encourage you to make contact with them if you haven't already, but it can also include people outside of our department. So the LSE does support cross-disciplinary or cross-departmental supervision in some cases. It can include both. As I said, do mention the languages, your language capabilities, but also your plans to acquire the language skills that you need. And I would also just say, make sure you proofread your statement of purpose. Make sure you read it very carefully yourself, but ask someone else to read it to make sure that the language is flowing, the prose is fluent, but also to make sure that you've got across your own kind of motivations, your passions, your desire, but also your the kind of reasons why your application is a good fit for our department and our program. I'm just going to take a pause there and just ask, has anybody got any questions? And you can use the raise hand function, or you could just simply unmute yes, turn your camera on and ask a question, or feel free to use the chat function if you like. Has anybody got a question on the statement of purpose, that part of the application at this point? No? All right. Well, let me move on, and then maybe if you've got questions, then I will take them at the end. This is a workshopping session, so do feel free, honestly, to jump in and ask any questions you might have. Okay, let me move on to the research proposal. Now, again, you can find this information on our website, so I'm not offering anything particularly novel here, but I'd like to just talk through some of these points so that you might have a better idea of how you go about including them in the research proposal. And as with the statement of purpose, we're not looking for a long essay, a long document. We're looking for really a concise document of about 1,500 words. If you find yourself going to 5-10 pages, you're going too far. And one of the exercises of this research proposal is being able to explain the significance of your research proposal or your proposed research and explain why you think it's so important and necessary to actually undertake it. What's it going to add? What's it going to contribute to the existing knowledge, to our existing knowledge and historiography that is available? So firstly, you want to say what your general topic is, and it needs to be quite clear. You might want to give a very precise question. Number two, what question or questions do you want to answer when looking at that general topic? If you find yourself going to three or four paragraphs to try and explain what that question is, then you might want to revisit it and have another look, because what you want is to be able to articulate very early on what the topic is that you're interested in, what the precise research questions are that you want to answer, and then in the rest of the proposal to develop how you're going to go about answering that question. When talking about what questions you want to answer, one of the things you might want to also explain is why those questions are important. Why is it significant that you are asking these questions? What has informed the reason for you asking that question and the way you are asking it? What is the, you might want to tie this into the historiography. So you might want to link it with key literature and its limitations. So to what extent has this question arisen from your reading of the existing secondary sources and your knowledge of the historiography, and you've seen a gap, for example, or you've seen a problem in the way in which historians have so far tackled this topic. So to what extent is your question kind of related to the literature and its limitations? You might also be raising this question in relation to new sources that have become available, new material that has been new archival sources or new potential to undertake large-scale oral history project. But as I said, when you're, you know, you need to state that question or questions very clearly, but also kind of explain what has led you to ask those questions as well. You will also want to include in your research proposal a discussion of what your main hypotheses are. Now, at this stage, obviously, you're just proposing research, right? So you haven't got all the answers. But what you want to suggest is what you're going to, what by asking this question, what do you hope or expect to find? What is the going to be the what is going to be the outcome of this thesis? How do you see it resulting in a, yes, in a 100,000 word PhD dissertation thesis, but perhaps subsequently, why might a book, as most PhD theses, the idea is hopefully to one day publish them as a book, what would a book on this topic actually add to our existing knowledge? What would it, what do you hope to prove? Yeah, what do you hope to prove? What do you hope to find? Would be some things to include under the point four heading there. And then the question is methods, right? What methods do you hope to use to answer this question, to try and test out those hypotheses? What kind of research methods are you going to be using? Now, I think because we're history is kind of sometimes we're considered an arts subject, and there's a tendency to shy away from more kind of the kind of scientific kind of approach sometimes to research. We sometimes shy away from talking about methods, or we get worried about methods. But I mean, essentially, you're asking, you know, what archives are you going to be using? What sources are you going to be using, and how are you going to read those sources, right? How are you going to actually interpret those sources, evaluate those sources? Will you be reading with the grain? Will you be reading against the grain of those sources? What can they offer? What can they not offer? Will you be using an oral history approach? If so, have you got experience in oral history? How are you going to sample? How are you going to choose the people that you are going to select to interview? What kind of questions will you ask? Would you use a kind of structured interview? Would you use an open interview kind of approach? If you're thinking of an international history project, you know, one of the central things of international history is the multi-archival approach to research. The combination of different perspectives, the cross-referencing of different archival collections to gain an understanding not just of policy from one direction to another, the kind of linear kind of one-directional kind of international history, or British policy towards Egypt, for example, but you want to maybe think about how are you going to use Egyptian sources to also look at Britain, or how are you going to look at a combination of different sources? So you want to explain to some extent the kinds of methods that you're interested, or even perhaps the kind of models, the kind of the works and the historical approaches that you have been particularly inspired by and that you might want to replicate or think through. And when you're thinking about methodology, I mean, the other thing to think about is that methodology can draw on other disciplinary approaches as well. So you might want to think about anthropology methods, ethnographic studies. You might want to borrow from other disciplines that might help you inform the way in which you're analyzing visual, non-textual sources as well. Number six on there is, what are your case studies, if any, and what are your case selection criteria? This depends on the topic. It might be that this isn't actually relevant for your research proposal, but essentially we're asking, why have you chosen the particular topic that you're choosing to answer kind of the bigger question? If it's a very thematic, broad question, and you're using a particular country or particular set of countries or particular relationship to answer that broader question, you need to explain why those case studies are important. If you're doing a comparative study, why have you chosen to study, compare the different cases that you have chosen to compare? I think with any comparative study, we need a rationale, a justification for why you have decided to select the kind of scale and the type of examples that you're looking at. But really, you want to end with, and this comes back to the central point of the research proposal, is, you know, what contribution will this research make to existing historiography? So yes, you want to explain what you want to ask, how you're going to ask it, how you're going to answer it, how you're going to test out your theory. But ultimately, you want to be saying, why is this significant? So what? You know, why should you spend the next 4 years of your life intensively full-time researching this topic? I'm a historian as well, so I fully understand the answer because it's interesting. But you need to prove to others that it's interesting, and they may be people outside of your particular area of expertise. So you want to be persuading, selling your topic to an informed group of historians, members of the department, why it is that your particular area of expertise, or what you would like to be your particular area of expertise, deserves a new book written on it, or essentially that's what, you know, that's what the aim of the whole process is. Again, I'm going to pause there before I move on to the some of the do's and don'ts and what happens when you've submitted your application. So I don't know if anybody has any questions. Please do use the raise hand function, or just unmute and speak. We've got quite a few. There's not too many of you in the room at the moment. Anybody would like to ask a question? No? Okay. Well, let's we go on to the next section then. So I said I would talk a bit about do's and don'ts. So when we're coming to workshopping our application, so what are some of the things to avoid, some of the things to make sure that you do manage to do? I think up there, number one, you know, by far and away number one, is to make sure that you have been in touch with your prospective supervisor and that they are interested in your proposal before you send off your application. I think there's often some kind of trepidation as to whether academics are too busy, whether you don't want to bother them with an email. But actually, that's what we're here for, right? It's exciting for us to be thinking about taking on PhD students, to be working with us. And actually, we would much rather hear from you sooner so that we can then ask questions and maybe help you develop that research proposal prior to you submitting it. Particularly if it's a topic that we're really excited about, but we think that it would stand a better chance if, you know, we could help tweak it and or give you some advice and feedback on perhaps new archival sources that you might want to consider that you might not be aware of. It's also important to contact prospective supervisors because it might just be that they are full up, that they can't take anyone on that next year. They might suggest, you know, next year I can't take anyone on, but the following year I'd be really excited to work with you. And so rather than going through the whole application process, submitting all your materials, and then finding that your supervisor isn't actually available, perhaps because they've got too many students, or perhaps because they're on sabbatical next year, or they're on leave for other reasons, find out early whether they're actually accepting proposals and whether they actually are open to taking on new PhD students next year. This is, you know, it's not necessarily to do with your proposal, but it might be just kind of just circumstantial that there is a problem with being able to accept PhD students. And in some cases, they might suggest someone else that you can work with and that you can get in touch with them. But I would also say, if you don't get an answer, or you don't get a reply, you might want to question whether you want to work with that supervisor, right? Because a PhD program is a, you know, you enter into quite a kind of detailed and close relationship with your supervisor or supervisors. They play a very important role in helping you through the PhD process and your research project. And in a sense, when you're contacting prospective supervisors, I wouldn't be too worried about thinking about them interviewing you. I would be more thinking about you interviewing them. I would be thinking that you need to really work out who you might want to work with for the next 4 years. Are you going to be working with someone who is going to engage meaningfully with your work, who is going to ask questions, who's going to give you feedback on proposals? Are you, is there someone that you've spoken to who you find that you would be able to work with on a personality basis? Do they seem like they could guide you and help you? Or, I don't know, are they so intimidating that you probably wouldn't be able to even talk to them about their ideas? I hope that's never the case, but you never know. Or are they too vague and, you know, don't really know about your expertise, that, you know, you're not sure that they could give you the kind of level of detailed support that you really require? But do think of that when you're reaching out to PhD supervisors. Think about you not necessarily as being the applicant and asking them for something, but really you're the one who's interviewing them just as much as the other way around. I think the other thing to say is a recommendation, the do's of your application process, is to reach out to other people, other PhD students in the department. So most departments have websites where they have email addresses and information about PhD students in the department. Send a PhD student in the department an email, see if they'd be willing to meet for coffee or online for a Zoom chat. Ask them what it's like to study in the department. If you can find a PhD student working with the supervisor you want to work with, even better, because you can find out what it's really like to work under their supervision. But do kind of ask around, see what it's like to work in that PhD environment. Let me turn to the don'ts, and I'm really pleased to see I've got a question here, so I'll turn to that in a second. But on the don'ts, you know, and this relates to the do's, don't submit an application vaguely in the hope that some supervisor in the department will take you on. You know, this will just, it may work, but it's often that it will reach a number of people in the department and they'll say, well, they can't have been that interested. They never got in touch, or they never really asked me about what I thought of their project. You know, if you don't even mention them on the on your application as being someone that you might want to work with, they might be unsure of, like, you know, whether there's you know, what the reason is that you've applied to the Department of International History. I would also say so be precise, be explicit about who you want to work with, what you want to work on. Don't submit just to one place when you're applying for a PhD. It's an extremely competitive process. Cast your net wide and do really think about applying to a range of different institutions. I mean, you can decide, you'll only ever do, if you're going to do a PhD, you'll only ever do it at the LSE. And in some cases, that maybe is what I should be suggesting. But I want to be honest here and say, you know, shop around. It might be that different institutions also come with different funding packages. You might not be able to get funding at your top choice, but you might get a fully funded place at another place. I would never suggest going to your top choice without funding and giving up a fully funded place elsewhere, right? Funding is very important for being able to carry out a PhD for the majority of applicants who will need some kind of financial support to carry them through the four years of the PhD. And let me just finish with one final don't, and that is, don't leave things till the last minute. Right. So there's always deadlines for when you have to apply for the program and when you have to apply to be considered for funding, for example. In our case, it's the 14th of January. However, at this time, graduate admissions in the LSE, but in probably all institutions, and even more so if, you know, we're in the midst of a difficult phase of the pandemic, as is common right now, are overwhelmed with applications coming in, and it can take a few days to get to departments, right? This is even more so the case if your referees don't submit on time. So you can submit maybe all of your materials on time, but if your referees do not submit by that date or in advance of that date, it will hold up the application getting to the department and to being assessed by the department itself. So yes, I would say encourage, you know, chase your referees, make sure they're going to submit by the deadline. If you haven't heard that they have submitted, or if you haven't heard from them, kind of send them a gentle reminder, or in the last, you know, instance, you might even perhaps think of asking another referee to step in, yeah? And someone else who could write a reference to that will can speak on your behalf. Because, yeah, we only see full applications. So if the referee hasn't been submitted, a reference hasn't been submitted, it won't get to us to be assessed. And all of these things is, you know, don't leave things to the last minute, because if one of these things goes wrong, then obviously you're left scrambling, and it's a horrible situation to be scrambling and kind of emailing and worrying about things getting there in time for the deadline. So I would just put a plea in to you, because I think it's also easier if things get to us earlier, we can begin assessing things earlier. Just a plea, don't leave your application, if you are applying to the LSE, till the 13th of January. Think about applying sooner. Okay, so we have a question in the chat. Is it possible to engage cross-department faculty, for instance, faculty from Economic History and International History Department? Thank you very much for the question. Yes, it is. It is absolutely possible. It does depend to some extent on how the individuals involved feel about the prospect of co-supervision and co-supervising this project. So they have to also be included in these plans to reach out to two of you. Yeah. So if you're thinking of, you might want to email both initially, but if you get enter into conversations with them, you might want to then explain why you might want to also draw or bring in someone from economic history as well to work on supervising the project, and vice versa. You might want to write to both of them together. I think in some cases that might be the simplest. Say I'm approaching both of you because I would like to ask you to consider the prospect of co-supervising a PhD project. Is this a possibility? Are you both available? Would it be something that you'd consider? So, I think the best way forward with this is just to be as direct and honest and transparent as possible. Zaid asks, I was just wondering whether it would be possible to defer the application. I'm guessing, Zaid, that you mean if you were offered a place and then you weren't able to take up the place? Is that what you're asking? Well, let me answer that question then. So in the past that has been possible. So we have had situations where people have they have been offered a place, but then either because they didn't get funding, or because of personal circumstances or job reasons and career reasons, they haven't been able to take up the place in September. And in the past, it was a possibility of deferring your place. Now, I have to say that last year, that was actually something that the LSE stopped us being able to do. And partly that's to do with the pandemic, partly it's to do with the huge numbers of applications we got last year, which was an unusual year, partly because a lot of US programs closed their PhD, their admissions for a year. And so actually this year, we were not allowed to defer offers for a full academic year. I actually have to be honest and say I'm not exactly sure what the situation will be next year. You can maybe contact graduate admissions to ask them directly on that, because it's a centrally LSE managed process. However, I will say that those people who were not able to take up their offer were offered the opportunity to reinstate their application automatically, you know, so simply kind of reapply with the expectation that they would be again offered a place. But it's a bit more of a gamble, because it might be that the supervisor fills up, or the supervisor is on leave, for example, which might complicate things. So it has been possible in the past. It wasn't possible this year. It may be possible again, but if it's not possible, then there is a possibility to reinstate your application I think with, very, very simply online. So you don't have to reapply completely. You can just reinstate it. So it reappears on our systems. Anybody else have any questions at this stage? Okay, let me just turn on to just the last couple of things that I wanted to talk about. And that is the studentships, the funding. Now, one of the funding, some funding that is available is the LSE studentship, which is essentially covers fees and a living stipend for 4 years. This is something that we, I think, is a wonderful opportunity. The downside is we've got very few studentships to offer. Fewer since the pandemic started, unfortunately. But the Department of International History at the LSE will have only three studentships to award to start in September 2022, which makes the decision and the competition for getting these studentships incredibly difficult, and the decisions incredibly hard, actually. The decisions made by a committee within the department, our research committee. So we have the LSE studentships. I've given you some pointers of how we assess applications in when we're thinking of awarding studentships, when we're making those difficult decisions, what we're looking for. But let me turn to the other opportunity, main opportunity that is available to LSE applicants and those who get an offer to study at the LSE, and that is the the London Arts and Humanities Partnership, LAP for short. You'll hear people talking about LAP, but the London Arts and Humanities Partnership is a consortium of different universities in London, and they have money that they can award to people who have got an offer to study at one of their partner universities. And essentially, this is a studentship that will cover fees and a living stipend. It's only for 3 years, but LSE will top up the fourth year of that. If you were to be awarded a LAP studentship, you would get the 4 years funded, as with the LSE studentship. Now, the LAHP works on a system that you have to have received an offer before you can apply for the London Arts and Humanities Partnership. And if I tell you that the deadline for applying to the LAP for a studentship, for funding essentially, is the 28th of January, that is even more of a reason to submit your application early, because you will have had to submit your application, been considered for a place, and all of our those we consider for a place are interviewed. So we'll have to arrange for an interview, and then you'll have to receive an offer, and then you'll only be able to apply to the LAP. So it's another reason for applying early. But so the deadline is the 28th of January next year, early next year. And I would point you to the website. So do go and have a look at the London Arts and Humanities Partnership. You can find it through Google very easily. And go into their website, where you'll find enormous array of different resources to choose from. One of the things that you'll find is the frequently asked questions, and I've only done a very small screenshot, but they go on for much longer, where you can find out a little bit more about how to apply, who can apply, what they're looking for, and what the different types of kind of awards or topics and projects that they have sponsored so far. There's also a very useful online tutorial for applying for a studentship this year. So go onto YouTube, find this. It's also linked to the website, the London Arts and Humanities Partnership website, and watch it, because you have Alison Blunt there in the top right-hand corner, who directs the London Arts and Humanities Partnership, explaining very clearly what they're looking for and how the process works. One last thing on the LAP, the London Arts and Humanities Partnership. It has a number of Black and global majority studentships. that are available to those who the awards are made to British, Black and global majority doctoral applicants, right? So essentially it's a ring fencing of a number of awards to really tackle the underrepresentation of Black and global majority doctoral students that are currently studying in the UK. Now, all applications are assessed in exactly the same way as every other application, but students who identify as people of colour, BME, or are part of the Black and global majority racial and ethnic groups will be eligible to be considered for one of the studentships in addition to this. So I think there are five ring-fenced studentships that are available. And, you know, you just have to, it's a question of ticking a box to indicate your eligibility to be considered for one of these studentships when you apply. But I thought it worth flagging that. I think it's an important and actually very welcome thing that the London Arts and Humanities Partnership are doing. There's me talking Latin America again. It's been a long term. all right. I think that's basically all I had to say for now. So I'm going to stop my share and I'm just going to say that we've got about 10 minutes left. This was a workshopping your application session. I hope you found it useful. Any questions? Any doubts? I don't know whether you were coming with you've already really got your application kind of almost nailed. You were just waiting to come here and just make sure you've got it all sorted, or whether you may be considering a PhD in the future. Maybe it's something you might think about later on, but I'm here for the next 10 minutes to answer any questions you might have. One thing I'm going to do, because we don't seem to have any questions, so I'm going to maybe close the recorded part of this session. What I'm going to do is maybe stop recording, and then anybody who wants to ask a question but might not want to do so, you know, in a recorded kind of situation, can feel completely happy and comfortable doing that without worrying that, you know, they're going to be recorded forever and put on YouTube or whatever. So thank you all for coming. For those who are watching it online and who are not here live, I hope this has been helpful and useful to you. For everybody else, and if you have a kind of question you'd like to ask a bit more privately, please stay around while I just turn off the recording. Okay, thanks very much.